Welcome to Next Us 818 Podcast, a reflective platform for connecting past successes with future progress in the African American community. I am your host, Dr. JC. The inaugural season of Next Us 818 Podcast features descendants of the 6888 Central Postal Directory Battalion, the only all African American, all female battalion to serve in the European Theater of Operations during World War II. I am pleased to welcome to Episode 7, two descendants of Odessa Taylor Marshall, who served in the 6888. My guests tonight are James and Jerry Marshall, the sons of Odessa Taylor Marshall. Welcome, James and Jerry.
We're glad to be here, and thanks for welcoming us.
And thank you for having us on the show. Appreciate it.
I'd like to start tonight with a few interesting facts that you shared with me. First, James, you are a well-known collector of Women's Army Corps memorabilia and artifacts, and you have a traveling exhibit. Additionally, you have a museum of enslavement through emancipation research and community outreach. We're going to talk some more about that in a minute. Second, your younger brother, John Winston Marshall, is a dedicated serviceman after whom a post office is named in the Los Angeles area. And third, your oldest brother, Dr. Joseph Marshall, received the MacArthur Genius Award. This award is given to a select group of individuals who have shown original creativity in their pursuits and a capacity for self-direction. That's pretty amazing. All of those accomplishments are pretty amazing. And we're gonna hear more about them as we move on and talk more about your siblings. But right now, I actually wanted to talk about your mom, Odessa Taylor Marshall. So she's originally from Tennessee, I understand. Is that correct?
Yes, Stanton.
Stanton, Tennessee. I assume that's a little town somewhere in Tennessee that's near.
Little rural town at that time in 1923.
They got one stop sign. Say you coming into Stanton. On the other side, they say you leaving Stanton. It's a small place.
What part of Tennessee is that in? Is that near the border of, or is that just Central Tennessee someplace?
Probably more or less Central Tennessee, not that far from Memphis.
Okay, right. So how old was your mom when she enlisted?
Roughly she was 18 years old.
Okay. So she enlisted at high school?
Yes, she did. Right. But that's not the age you can enlist at. You had to be 21, but she enlisted at 18.
Okay. How did that happen?
Well, because she wanted to go in, you know, because the job opportunities were just menial domestic jobs. She was working in Fort Leavenworth, Missouri. And working in the hospital, she did the work what African Americans do at that time, and that's changing beds, you know, and helping, doing the assistance. So she found a greater opportunity. Well, she told her father that she wanted to enlist. He said, no, she can't go in service. So next thing you know, she's in there. First time she ever defied her father too, and that's amazing.
You know, go ahead, James.
Oh, I was gonna say, and she just moved forward, but at the time they weren't asking for birth certificates. That's a good thing. So she had a high school diploma, but they weren't asking for birth certificate to verify her age. And so she moved it up and she was able to get in.
Sounds like the story of one of my uncles. They didn't ever, there was always some confusion about his age. They never asked his birth certificate when he enlisted either.
And when you think about the context in the 1940s for Black women and Black men in the Jim Crow South in Tennessee, you know, there was a reason to try to look for something better. And, right. You know, so the opportunity for her to join the military, I mean, that was a way for her to say, hey, I got to leave the South and do something better. So it was not only defying her grandfather, but, you know, it's when you think about the context of what she was living in, she wanted to make a better way.
Although at that time, it was a pretty courageous decision to enlist in the 40s. What do you think made her special? There were a lot of people who wouldn't have made that same decision at that time. To take off, go to someplace you're unfamiliar with, take those risks.
Well, I just believe that Malcolm said anything but here, anywhere but here. And she just said, I have to get out of here. And it looks like better opportunity to be provided, especially with job training. And when they were advertising recruiting, they gave them better opportunities for advancement in trades and education.
And I thought that, already giving back, working in the nursing area, taking care of people. But when you do that and you see that there might be an opportunity, you got to take a risk. And my mother wasn't about to just settle. So she wanted to find her path. So she took a risk. And to be able to join the military at that time when they, Black women weren't supposed to even be in the military, she took that risk and it paid off. So I advocate to a lot of folks, sometimes in life, we just got to take a risk and see where it takes us.
What did she do when she returned after she completed the military service?
Well, she went to camp. What she did when she came home, she entered college and took more vocational skills. She started learning to advance her typing and all the things in English and also nursing courses. So she followed that pursuit after the service.
So did she use the GI Bill? Sorry. Go ahead, Jerry, I'm sorry.
One thing I was grateful for, what she did afterwards, she met my daddy. Because when she met my father, the rest of us came out. And that's a whole story within itself, because they both served into the military, right? So, and my mother, who was, a little bit of an introvert, shy, quiet, following orders, doing what she needed to do to be successful. And then I got this extroverted, larger than life father, and those two came together, right?
So did she meet him through the service or totally unrelated to the service?
James, that was after the service, right?
Yeah, after the service, they met at Tucker College in St. Louis.
Okay.
And he used to see her in, during their school hours. And there was a school dance. And school dance. So they invited my father, asked my mother out if she could go. She said, well, I have to bring my mother and father. So they escorted her there. And they all sat at the table. And my dad had a cop of a new demeanor. Go over and approach him, and then they was able to dance and further, make a deeper connection.
So he's from Tennessee also?
No, he's from Vicksburg, Mississippi.
Vicksburg, Mississippi. They both tried to get away from the South.
Well, he was drafted, but he went in, yeah.
Okay. So are there any stories that your mother shared with you about her time in the service, any adventures, or any painful or scary or funny memories?
Well, I have one that when they were over in England, her and a few of her friends, they were just out walking and just having fun. And next thing they know, they went across the border that weren't supposed to be there. And next thing you know, MPs all showed up and told them, you guys have to go back. And that was funny because I'm saying, you little country girls, you guys just having a ball, yeah, in the South. So you just skipping and hopping, and MPs had to bring them back. So that was just not knowing their geography or where they were. They were just engrossed in just having a good time.
It's funny you should. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jerry.
She was adventurous because she told me at one time that she always wanted to see these things called the windmills. And in Holland, I think they had all these windmills. So her and a group of her fellow soldiers decided to go over there when they shouldn't have been there, right? Mm-hmm. And again, the MPs had to come get them, right? But they were just fascinated with the countryside. And you can imagine coming from the United States, going over to Europe, and then, being treated different. Segregation was, they were accepted over there. And so she just felt comfortable and felt like that she could adventure out and see things. So that was a funny story when she went over there to see those windmills, because she was just fascinated.
My mother, when she talked about her experiences all the time, but she always talked about the adventure, and she took lots of photos. But again, it's the same kind of the being able to see the world and go to different places in France and Belgium and England. But it's the spirit of adventure that she that she brought back to share with us the most.
Another story, she didn't tell me about this story, but I think someone was researching on the 6AAA and they came across my mother's story, because she was in the 6AAA Central Postal Battalion, but since they were all inclusive and having their own city, she worked in the medical area because she was a surgical technician. So this one lady told me that there's this one woman named Odessa, when bombs were dropping over in England, that would leave the shelter and go get people and bring them back. And I couldn't even imagine my mother having the fortitude to leave when bombs were dropping, but she was so dedicated to her profession that she would go out and help anyone. I mean, if you were suffering, you were hurting, she'd go out, bring folks with them, bring them back so that they could get that medical attention. So for me to hear that about my mother, because she never talked about it. She was one of the silent generation, don't talk about too much. But to hear about her and her little tiny self going out and braving the elements, facing bombs, endangering, putting her life in danger to help others, really, really settled in my heart, you know, to let me know about perseverance and your ability to survive. Hey, it's in my DNA because of her.
As you know, Dr. Brenda Moore wrote a book about the 6AAA entitled "To Serve My Country, To Serve My Race." And your mom is quoted in there. She's quoted as saying the military changed her life in many ways. It gave her more independence and it made her more aggressive. And she became a strong advocate for women's rights. How did you see that manifested in your mom's community and civic engagement?
Well, I would say one thing. She was also one of the co-founders of the National Black Military Women. So she participated a whole lot with her WAC charter, and her service went out through the charter, and she did volunteering work through her WAC charter in Sacramento.
Is that the NABVET?
I saw
that. Yes, yeah, the one that Lieutenant Colonel Patricia Kelly is a chair of.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are they based, Jerry?
I may have saw a lot of that when growing up in Los Angeles, after they moved from St. Louis to Los Angeles, and there was like nine of us in a one bedroom, two bedroom house on 62nd Street.
Well, one bedroom first, and 3 years later we moved to a two bedroom house.
But the way she and my father and organized, I say her and my father, but she was General Odessa. She really ran the household. Right. But the way they organized things and in this military way, we would go shopping and, you know, they would buy in bulk. And I can remember us coming back in the station wagon, lining up in one line, passing groceries down to the freezer or wherever it had to go. But everything was really organized, the way the beds were made, the way we slept and who slept in what room and what time we got up. And in the morning, Father would get us up and we go over across the street to do calisthenics, 5:30 in the morning, all these little skinny little bodies running out there doing their exercises. So the military definitely had an impact on her life and how she organized things.
And then that's when we didn't have carpet. So we did a lot of scrubbing floors, and you can imagine with that family, the dishwashing. So one washed, the other dried, the other put away. So we had that kind of order going on.
So how many of the marshals enlisted in the service?
It was, besides my mother and father, I went next. I was a Vietnam veteran. And then John went into the Iraq War. So it'd be three of us.
Okay.
And we have a niece. Yeah, she's the second lieutenant of the Marines.
Do you recall any particular lessons that your mother learned through her service that she passed on to the family? Or I guess in this case, it'd probably be your mother and your father.
Well, my father said Odessa never knew how to cook. So she learned how to cook and became a great cook. And she taught us how to cook. I can pass that on about that.
Any values or traditions that came through their service that they passed on to the family?
I would say with me, my mom taught me a lot of quiet discipline, right? She didn't really fuss about things. She just gave me the spirit of excellence that if you do it, you do it well. I can remember, and you follow the rule of law, because I can remember one night she took me and John to go see, of course, The Guns of Navarone, a World War II movie. And we had to take the bus all the way down to the theater and come back. And it was like, when we got back, it was like 10 o'clock at night. And I could still remember us holding onto our mother's hands that we were getting ready to cross the street. And the light was red. And me following orders, and mom, we can't cross. And no cars were there. Nothing was in the street. And she grabbed our hands and started walking across on the red light. And I was fighting against her because she was violating the law, right? So she just pulled us along and we got to the other side. And I could still remember looking back to see if we were going to be caught, because my mom never violated the rule of law, but here she walked across the red light. So I was kind of like a little bit traumatized, but she had a way of keeping us in line, and that was good. So her quiet discipline about doing things and the way you did things was always never second guess, do the right thing.
And for me, I was an incorrigible child. So I was always mischievous child. I was always into something.
This is true.
And one thing to pacify me, my mother understood that, and she just unconditionally loved me till I finally got my head together. And she just gave me a lot of unconditional love. I didn't listen that much because I wanted to venture out on my own as a kid. But she just gave me a lot of unconventional love, and when I needed her, she was there.
So James, the 6888 women were divided into companies. Do you know what company your mother was in? Because I know you were the kind of historian.
You know, the company she was in, I have all those records back in the office. So I can't recall that right now, but I have that in the office. Yeah.
Yeah, my mother was in Company A. So I'll be, check that out. I'll be interested to know.
I'll definitely do that. Which
company she was in. So now I want to segue and talk about you guys and your seven siblings, big family. So tell me about your careers and your background. Who wants to start first?
My career is, after I got out the Army, I became a clerk typist, and I did quartermaster, and I was a clerk typist and a chauffeur in the Army for a Black lieutenant colonel in Okinawa. And then when I got out, I went to Harvard College, got my AA degree, and I became a police officer at the University of California, Los Angeles. So I stayed there for a good 9 years. And I ventured out into real estate and did other things I thought would be more promising and paying more. And from there, I just did odd jobs until I decided I needed to start my business. And I started that 25 years ago. And that is janitorial and hauling company. But I went on to get my BA from Cal State Dominguez. And that's where I've been ever since.
You also have your master's degree.
Yeah, my master's too. But my passionate love is behavioral science, archaeology, anthropology. The master's is in education. You know, I did that because my other brothers and sisters had their master's, and I didn't want my parents to have me not achieving that. So I went on and attained that.
You know, I was the baby boy. So I kind of watched what happened with Joseph and James and John, my older brothers ahead of me. And my parents were very, very strict about education, getting your lessons done.
Yeah.
So they were like Joseph and John, you know, they couldn't play sports. It was like, come home, get your study, do your homework. And they kind of like wore my parents out by the time I got there. So when I got up, they said, I don't care, just do your homework. And if you want to play basketball, play sports, go ahead. So I fell in love with sports, right? So I ended up playing basketball. But what they set into motion was that once you get out of high school, college wasn't an option. It wasn't even a second thought. It was like grade 12, grade 13, you just keep going and you get your degree, right? So when Joe got his degree and James got his degree and Deborah got her degree, it was like, when I got along, it's like, I'm supposed to get a degree. And my mother was so proud of all of us going through college that she created a wall in the room with everybody's degree on it. So we had a wall of fame with everybody's degree. So when James says one person got a degree, And he didn't have his. He went back and got a degree because we were all competing to make our parents be proud of us. So I end up, you know, getting my bachelor's degree in environmental studies. And I got a master's degree in health physical education administration and a bachelor's degree in counseling. So it all led to, you know, us just doing what was necessary in an educational sense for our parents to be proud of us. And I've retired from working as an educator in the California Community College system.
Your family sounds like mine, where people would ask, well, when did you know you were going to get a terminal degree? I said, when I was born. I said, you just kind of you're born knowing that whatever you pursue the maximum degree. And then we'd always have to fight with my dad. Once we'd get it, whenever we'd get the diploma, he would take it so he could put it on his wall. It's like, wait a minute, we at least need a duplicate. So.
But when you think about the narrative of within this country, you know, I have to speak the truth. They told us at one time we couldn't even read or write. It was a crime to read or write or to be educated. So, you know, when you think about generation after generation, education became very important for folks of color, right? And so our parents, it was mandatory that you got an education, right? It was like there was no option. There was no secondary thinking about it. This is what you do. And it has really led us up, our family, into upward mobility. Everyone has a degree. Everyone has a nice paying job. Everyone has, you know, got their houses. And so it was almost part of the dream that they always wanted to have. Even though they had a GI Bill to do what they did, I look at it because the military was segregated at the time. So I look at that sometimes with the analogy is white folks may have a credit card to go anywhere they wanted to, when Black folks may have had an EBT card. You can only go to certain places and get in certain things. It wasn't the option of a GI Bill wasn't open to them to go everywhere because of the circumstances of where they live, redlining, and all these other things. So we have always been a people who've been able to make something out of nothing. And to me, that's critical, our ability to be resourceful and resilient. And that comes from our folks having hope that there's going to be something better for us than that they had.
And I just pray that some of the generations behind us have not lost that hope.
No, we are their hope. And we see that in some of our younger kids and our grandkids. I mean, they're smarter than we were. And the fact that we still have hope that they will succeed and they have the wisdom of us still here. So I'm very hopeful. I'm very hopeful.
I see that in the generations that the children that we raise, that our lineage, but there's so many young African Americans that don't have, that didn't come from the families that we came from. They don't have the same kind of family support. Those are the young kids that I worry about.
So, I believe within their DNA that okay. They will survive. I mean, we've been through hell and back, right?
Well,
and we're
true.
Still here. So, you know, they may have to learn it a little different. And, you know, we can't even predict what's going to be in the future. But I believe in our young people. And, you know, now you hear the educator come out of me. I believe in our young people. I believe that they may get there. You know, they may have to go through the school of hard knocks, but they're going to get there.
And I'd like to add another thing about my education. It wasn't destined for me to go to college. They kicked me out of Catholic school in the sixth grade and sent me to public school. And when you put me in public school, you had the baddest people in the world in public school, okay? I could never go to school without a fight happening in that school. So the attitude, that aggressive attitude I had, you know, followed me till I got into high school. And my grades weren't good at all. And the people I ran with were hardcore guys. And then all of a sudden, my knight in shiny armor came out and says, J-Most, you got to go with me. I'm taking you away. And that's Doc Marshall. Mm-hmm. So Doc Marshall pulled me out. I spent time with him. He helped me get back on track and gave me Black history books. Malcolm X, James Baldwin.
This is your big brother.
Yeah, big brother. Yeah. And from there on, I that helped to advance me. My sister helped me advance me. We both went to Harvard Junior College together. And that's when everything took off for me. Everything took off for me in college. But if it wasn't for my brother, I wouldn't have achieved those degrees. High school education, but not college degrees. So I give a lot of kudos to my brother who helped me be the person I am today.
And he's doing so much, so many. I mean, Joe is a social entrepreneur, is working to redefine youth violence and put in place some prevention strategies. He's been done some amazing work with Omega Boys Club and Street Soldiers Radio.
Yes.
Any thoughts you want to share on the work that he's doing?
Well, I think it's great because I was his first student, you know, and I was a hardcore person to deal with. But he was effective with me, and I just admire him for him going on. And Joe's not the toughest person, but he's the most dedicated, and he's fearless. And so he could tackle a lot of, you know, at-risk youth and direct them, and he's been fantastic with that. And I can say all the good things that Joe has been fantastic.
And you know, for me, Doc is, and when I say Doc, I say my oldest brother, Joseph Earl Marshall Sr., named after my daddy. I think, you know, my parents gave him the fortitude for education, you know, formal education, go to school, do your homework, go to college. But at some point, even in formal education, something takes over where you have to do the self-learning. He started reading the books, Malcolm X, and he started raising his level of consciousness of us as a people, right? Hearing the narratives of our stories, the souls of Black folks, as they would say, right? And once you start to understand who we are and where we're from, then it educates, it raises our level of consciousness, and then we become self-hungry. The hunger to know, I think that starts to percolate in all of us. And so for me, when even though we can't really focus on our GPA, there's something that is in us, an ability to learn, to raise our ability to climb and to succeed is there. We just need someone to start to shake us up a little bit, put us on the right track, give us some information, and then our hunger to know takes over. And when we know who we are, we can go anywhere. And I think that's why I say there's so much hope in our folks, because our young people may not have the language to articulate what they're going through right now. But when we start to give them that language, that's why I say it's so important for us to have those elders, Dr. from my brother, from James, we are now those elders. And we can see what the young people are lacking. And when we can connect those dots, give them that inspiration and that hope, there's nothing that they can't do.
That's true. And we have to reach out to those families, those young people who don't have the family members, the elders, to do that for them. We have to be those elders for them.
Historically, you know, they tore our families apart.
Yes.
So biologically, we all family. You know, we take care of students in my classroom. They're my sons and my daughters. They may not be biologically my sons and my daughters, but they're my family. And when they can get that sense of family, that sense of love, that sense of hope that our grandmothers gave us, what's going to stop them from being successful in whatever endeavor they choose?
Yeah, an amen there.
Amen, as they would say in church.
So, James, tell us about the museum.
Well, the museum started out as what I said, the Museum of Enslavement to Emancipation. It started because they were trying to, we did a lot of work in the 60s to get the Black student unions in. And so it was a hard time. We boycotted classes, we did all that. So we finally got the curriculum we wanted. And then all of a sudden in 2010, 2009, they wanted to reverse our progress. So I told myself, I'm not gonna be asking to teach our history. I'm through with that. I'm going to teach the history of myself. So then I started the museum, and I taught all African-American history subjects. Once I started with Joe, my journey was on studying the history of African Americans. Not particularly so much Africans, but so much African Americans. I didn't go back to the motherland, just what was happening in the United States. And so I put together a lot of artifacts, a lot of PowerPoints, and I thought, oh man, I'm gonna make a lot of money. And so when I was ready to go to these schools and put the program together, they told me, man, we ain't got no money for you. So I said, hey, it don't make no difference. I'm teaching my African American history. I'll teach the history. So for a long time, I said, just give me a letter of appreciation about what I did. And so since 2010, I even took out the WAC exhibit. Not so much I labeled it 6888, but I've labeled it, you know, the first Black women in the World War II, which was a WAC. And so I kept teaching that. And now that, you know, the Congressional Gold Medal was awarded, the demand for that is just, you know, skyrocketed. So now I'm only teaching on the subject of the WAC and the 6888. And so that's how that got involved, because they were trying to reverse the curriculum we worked so hard to put in.
Yeah, well, I was saying, James is modest, because, you know, this last Veterans Day, he invited me to come down to help him with his display in Gardena, California. And I was putting up the 6888 Central Postal Battalion display. And it was amazing to see how many people don't know those stories. And to be able to be out there with him telling and sharing the stories, because he says he loves to educate people on our history, our story, sharing our narrative, showing the real facts, right? It's more than the money, right? It's the ability to help people understand the contributions that we have made that you don't hear about, right? And when they hear these stories, it makes them hunger to know more than not only the 6888, because you may hear about Tuskegee Airmen, but you may never hear about the All Black Tank Battalion, right? Or the Triple Nickels that were in World War II. All African American Balloon Battalion. Those are things you don't hear.
All of our hidden stories, all of our hidden figures.
Yes, and they're so powerful when you hear it. I saw folks' eyes light up like, I didn't know. So what James does is well beyond the money, the monetary. He's raising the level of consciousness of our people.
So James, how does one get in touch with you if they want to see the exhibit?
Well, usually they go through my email. I don't have a webpage, and that's the best way to get to me is the email, or I have business cards and I have flyers I give out. And because I can't do a lot of exhibits, I only have, unless I split what I have, I can only do two, and I got to put somebody else to narrate the story at another location. So I'm working on that now. You know, we got the okay from what Jerry said from the mayor from Gardena. They want us to exhibit to be in the January Dr. King parade. So I'm working on that to modify that, to, you know, to get a more captive audience. I want them to feel the intimacy of what I'm doing. And so I do the best I can with the visuals and the narratives to bring that about.
Well, I might have to come out to LA just so I can see your exhibit.
No, I would love that. I love it. And we can give giveaways too. So you always take something away.
Giving away the plane ticket to come? No, just kidding.
So James, if they want to know kidding. About how they can get the exhibit, can you give them your email address?
Right.
Because a good problem is to have a great demand. Even though we may not be able to do everything, to have everyone interested in having this exhibit is a good thing to have. We will figure out how we can get it to everybody, or to allow everybody to know the information. But if you're interested in seeing that exhibit, hearing him lecture about it, yes, go ahead and give him your email address, right. James.
So why don't you, yes, tell the audience your email address.
I do give that out.
Why don't you tell the audience right now?
Oh, the email is T as in Tom, C as in Charles, S as in Sam, 9001800@yahoo.com. The name of my company is Total Clean Services, so that's where you get the TCS from. So I'm always available on my email. And the collective, if you want to give my phone number, I don't mind giving that out. Okay, it's area code 323-381-6030.
Okay.
And the exhibit is more than you can dream, think, or imagine. It's powerful. It's our story.
Let me ask you one other question. One sibling we haven't specifically talked about, but I really want to focus on a minute, and that's John Winston Marshall. Tell me about John.
Jerry, you can begin, because Jerry was and John were closer in age. Yes. So I can follow up after that, because I was babysitting all of them. So
this is true. John was a year older than me, and I could still remember when we were just living in a house on 62nd. Our parents used to buy us toys, and we used to have those little small green army men. And John was, he was a soldier at heart, even since he was little. We'd have all those green army men, and he would take all the guys with the tanks and the bazookas, and he'd give me the infantry on my side, and we'd play these war games, and he would always annihilate me because he'd have the best weapons, right? But he was always strategic about what he did. I didn't understand what we were doing then, but he was actually training to be a military man. We used to walk to school sometimes, and sometimes we had to walk through the park. And when you walk through the park, the older kids would jump you and take your lunch money. And I would say, John, I didn't like to get into confrontation. So I said, John, why do we keep walking through the park when we could ride, go around the block and take the street and go to school? And he said, I got the right to go wherever I want to go. I said, but we're going to get beat up if we go this way. So I used to get frustrated. I said, well, I ain't going to go with you. But then my mother and father's voice would kick in. It's like, you don't leave your brother behind. That was a military thing. You don't leave your people behind. So you go with your brother. So I had to figure out, well, I'm going to hide my money in my sock or under my shoe so they won't get my money. They took my lunch. They didn't get my money, right? I didn't get my milk money. But he was a man about a principle. And he was like that all throughout high school. When he got his job, John had all kind of odd jobs, but he was always about being strategic and always doing the right thing to get what he wanted, whether it's apartment, whether it's his business. And then at some point in time, because opportunities were limited, he decided that he went to join the military, and he made a career of the military. And even until the day he was called over to Operation Iraqi Freedom, he was supposed to retire from the military. And he told us, he couldn't retire because his troop was called up and he didn't think they were ready. So he said, I can't leave my troops behind. And that's the same thing he told me in the park, you can't leave your brother behind, right? So he went with his squad over there because he said his job was to bring them back home. So my brother was, I call him General John. He's, he's the lifeblood of my heart. And I do things in excellence and in the name of John Winston Marshall, my oldest brother. I'm not going to let my folks in the classroom down, because John would have never let me down.
So he was tragically killed in Iraq?
Yes, he got ambushed. And James, you know that story better than I do. So you want to tell him exactly how that might have happened?
Oh, yes. And I want to add a little bit to what Jerry said about John early. I was a clarinet player in junior high school and in high school, and I was in the marching band. John took up playing the flute and the saxophone. And then when I came home from Okinawa, I had my military uniform on. John was really very impressed with that. And we have a family picture of that. And he he was an entrepreneur. John had a vending machine company before he went into service. So he had these little vending machines, which was cool. I mean, I thought that was fantastic. And because all of us had that entrepreneur nature in us. And then he enlisted in the Army. Did his 27 years of service. But what happened is that when John volunteered to lead his troops in, I looked at John. I said, man, you know, war is different. You know, these Arabs fight a different kind of war. You know, I mean, in Vietnam, I saw the results of going into a real determined opponent. And he says, well, you know, that I have, you know, this is what I have to do. And we ended that conversation. And once he volunteered to leave a convoy in the Baghdad, as he was leading this convoy, they came under ambush. One of his soldiers were on a Bradley tank shooting out grenades, a grenade launcher. And something happened to that young soldier up there. So John relieved the soldier. And he started taking up shooting out the grenades. And he was hit. And another Sergeant Sheaver from Washington State also were hit with the rocket-propelled grenade. And they died, you know, instantly. And it took about, in the book, Arthur wrote that he took about 3 or 4 days to go in there and find the remnants of his uniform. And they found that. But that's how he died. And that's the book Jerry showed you, in the Company of Soldiers. They have a nice, real good write-up about John in that. And so from his heroics, it was fantastic that he could do it. But anybody would do it. We would say, yep, that's my brother. He would do something like that, you know, and he did it and got honored for it.
You know? He was there for his men, and he received the Silver Star, correct, James?
Yes.
Bronze Star.
Yes.
And we're still fighting for his heroic to get the Congressional Medal of Honor, because he single-handed him and that sergeant saved the lives of everybody in their platoon.
And the Purple Heart, too. I'd put that there.
And so when you think about the post office that was named after him, it's kind of ironic, because my mother served in World War II with the Central Postal Battalion. And here's John, who died in Iraqi freedom, and he had a post office named after him. Now, my thoughts, and I always fight for this, is for that post office to be actually adopted by, within that area code, all the soldiers who served in the war. And that post office should be decorated with a Purple Heart, should be have a Silver Star on it, it should have a Bronze Star on it. And because of my mother's troop getting the Congressional Gold Medal, a Congressional Gold Medal should be on that post office. And all the military men in that area should make sure that that place stays pristine. And that's what I'm going to be pushing for.
Well, you have a better chance of getting that done now that you have a new mayor there.
This is true.
So. One thing is good about me starting a legislation to get the post office name at John is a journey, is that that's a subject, veterans is a subject that every politician likes. I had no argument, no problem, no nothing about, no, we're not going to do this, we're not going to sign it. Because I followed that whole thing up to President George Bush's death. And so I've been through all these committees. And so finally it became. But I had no problems from the other senators. I didn't know who Susan Collins was. I met her. And they all were for it.
And as the youngest brother, rightfully so. For a young man, John Winston Marshall, to give his life for his country, it's due, just like my mother's troop who got the got the Congressional Medal of Honor, it's due and it's overdue.
And I want to point, John's post office was never on my mind. You know, you're a soldier, I know how soldiers do it, they go in there and they die. But it affected my mother so much. That's what stopped me. It affected Odessa, and that was taking Odessa out of her norm. And I wasn't standing for that. You know, I said, George Bush, how you gonna come over here and take my mother's son after all she's been through? And so I said, I'm not gonna do this. So I had a memorial down here. I got Feinstein, Senator Feinstein, Maxine Waters, our supervisor, board of supervisors. I got every representative, and I had about 40 different proclamations laid out on the table for mom. And when Dianne Feinstein and Maxine Waters came up and told my mother, you know, I take responsibility for your son's death. And I said, wow, Max, that's strong. You know, and Dianne Feinstein, they all were very sorry for John, and they aided my mother. I thought that got my mother back to where she was prior to this incident. But after we came back from Arlington, and we was on my mother's airline, the one she likes all the time, which is Delta, and we hit some bad turbulence, she said, I said, Mama, let me hold on to you. She says, I said, I'm scared. She says, well, that's okay, because I'll be with John. I said, hold up. I said, that ain't my call.
She and John were kindering spirits. You know, she loved all the children the same, but I think she had a little something special for John, which she did, because John, her and John were just, I don't know what it is. But even when she passed away on his birthday.
Really?
And the magnificent thing about that is that I knew what I did didn't work. You know, putting all those proclamations out, calling all those federal and city and state representatives out, it didn't work. And so I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. What am I going to do next? And the newspaper came to my door and they says, in Monrovia, California, which is not too far from where I live, they named the post office after a soldier in Iraq whose tank flipped over in the Tigris and Euphrates River, which and he perished, and he got a post office name up and he got a citizenship. I said, oh man, I can do this for John. So I called his congressperson and they said, Mr. Marshall, we'll help you every way you can. So they sent me legislation. I put John's name where the other soldier was, gave it to Maxine Waters, and all this history. You know, and that's how we got it. You know, it's those circumstances came up, but Maxine was the greatest representative I ever have come across. And she fulfilled that and got us the post office.
And she's still going.
And that worked. Now that worked. The post office worked, you know. Yeah.
How old was your mom when she passed?
She's 94.
Okay, she did.
Now, how was that? This is just a side note, and I have to speak my truth. How old was the Queen of England when she passed? Was she 97?
97. I think she's 97, yeah.
So, and Dad passed when he was 97. Seven. Mm-hmm. So, for me, it's like, here's a woman, the Queen of England, who has the best medical care in the world, who lives to 97. And my mother and my father lived to 94 and 97. What's that say about us? Right? So we don't have the best of everything, but we have some resilience within our people that supersedes anything. And I want all our folks to know that, you know, never, ever, ever give up on your dreams, your hopes, your desires, because they can take you anywhere if you don't give up. I feel like I'm preaching now.
Well, this is good. This is good.
That's great.
Please share any reflections you have on what your mother's life and legacy mean to you and your family.
I was stunned because my mother, she belonged to her chapter, her WAC chapter in Sacramento. She would always go back on Veterans Day to visit John, but she was also the color guard in the stadium. So she had her uniform on. And I said, Mom, I ain't wearing my military clothes. I'm gonna throw on my kente cloth and everything. And we walking hand in hand. And as we're walking down, passing everybody, they were saluting her. And I'm thinking back, I said, Mom, you know, back in the day, they would have called you all kind of names. These soldiers wouldn't have saluted you. They didn't even think that you were worthy to be in there. But now I had generals saluting her, colonels saluting her. And I'm saying, wow. But I never knew about her real active role in Sixth Troop 8. I said, okay, maybe she's just doing it because she belongs to the chapter. That didn't hit me. And so the respect that she gathered, her no animosity towards no one. I said, you've been through a lot. She said, that's okay, I'm doing good. And so she gave me a lot of compassion and understanding, and that, you know, we have to move on and do what we have to do. And she was just so resilient in being who and what she is. And I was so proud of that. And we did that twice. But the second time was it's a conflict on the Air Force, on the airplanes. I wasn't going back again. But it was great. So that's what she gave me.
You gave me a sense of Black excellence. Even though I'm retired, I call it even fired because I reject certain ways. We just do things differently. We never go away. But she gave me this excellence to the hunger to know not only myself, but everything that I do and who is actually the enemy and who and the things that I need to overcome and to do it tirelessly. She also, James mentioned the word resiliency, the ability to bounce back no matter what. My mama went through hell and back and kept bouncing back and counts bouncing back and didn't complain. So I won't complain about nothing. I just bounce back, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, she had this unwavering faith, right? That no matter what, everything gonna be okay. And she didn't talk about it. You just knew it, right? And the hope for a better generation, the hope for her kids, she gave me that. And that's runs in my DNA. And the last thing I think she gave is love. She loved all of us. She loved us past any obstacle out there. So for my mother, she left me that Black excellence. She left me with resilience, faith, hope, and love. And with that, we can do anything. And my job, my obligation is to continue to pass that on. That's the legacy of my mother that runs through my veins.
And my mother's faith. When she was in St. Louis after she got out of the service, she saw some nuns. And she says, oh, they look so good in their little outfits. Well, next thing you know, she's a Catholic and all of us had Catholic education. just because of the nun's habit, she liked that habit and she was a devoted Catholic to the day she passed.
Yeah, another Catholic family. Yes, we multi-generational Catholics ourselves. Just a few more questions before we wrap up. So what do you think about your mother's decision to serve her country, certainly given the level of racism at that time?
To me, it didn't make any difference. Because they're going to have the racism at home or racism, and they didn't have the racism in the service. See, they were segregated. That was cool because it was already segregated. But the racism was really once they were outside of the military that she felt. But they were, she gave me the understanding that they were very well protected. And I know one thing is that the Black community backed the WACs. Mary Margaret Bethune, A. Philip Randolph, Colin Powell, Walter Reed, NAACP, all of them made sure their daughters, their mothers were going to be treated with respect. And they did. I know many WACs did suffer discrimination who didn't go overseas. They did discriminate in the United States with job assignments and things like that and overworked. I've read a lot about that. But they were better off in the service than they would have been in Tennessee or Georgia or Louisiana, you know. So that was...
It's just a sad commentary about America, isn't it?
Oh, very much so.
And that's why so many artists, you know, musicians and others, African-Americans moved to Europe and stayed there.
Yes, yes.
I agree. And the fact that she went into the military, what stood out with me is the limited options that Black folks had at that time, right? My father always told me he could either be a chauffeur or he could join the military. So there was more of an opportunity for him in the military, even though it was segregated, because he got a chance to travel. He went to North Africa. He went to Italy. He went to France. He went to Japan. So, yeah. So for a young African-American male at that time to see that, and my mother did the same because she went to Birmingham, England. Right. And this was fascinating about those women. When they went over to Birmingham, England, and the military was segregated, they had to be a city within a city. I mean, who was going to do those black women's hair over there, right? So you know how we are about the hair, right? So they had to order in their own products. They had to have their own recreation facilities. They had to have their own music that they had to bring into. She worked with the nurses. So when you talk about the companies A, B, and C, they were not only into military companies, but they created a whole city within a city to take care of themselves. What she gave me is we can do anything when we together. Because, you know, together we rise. And the excellence of that to me is outstanding. So I'm always pushing for us to know our narrative, to know our story, for us to stay together and watch us rise.
And a part of my exhibit is that my mother did get advanced training in Fort Huachuca. That was a military base that was housed the African-American soldiers and women. So now it takes on a whole different dimension on their recreation time. You can see men, black men and black women coming together. They had dances formed, and it's always just wonderful. And they were entertained by black entertainers. We have one big, real beautiful picture of Joe Louis. He's on her base, and all these blacks are surrounding Joe Louis. They're all happy and everything. I said, go, Joe. So it was homogeneous, and I like that part. You know, nobody felt cast out. That's the good thing. Or my mother never mentioned she felt being cast out.
They made something out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And my final question, I think you've answered this, but I'm gonna ask it anyway. What lessons from your mother's life story can you share to inspire young African Americans to embrace fear as opportunity in order to shatter glass ceilings and be their best selves?
Well, I would say advance yourself with opportunity, with education, because my mother pushed education. I mean, that's all we did was push education. She saw that was the best way to be successful. And so pursue your education, become the best who you can be with the education, and further it and develop your career.
And for me, I always say for our young people, know who you are. And if you don't know who your grandmother and your grandparents were. Know your family lineage and ask the questions. Ask why were they the way they were, right? Because you can get the formal education, but when you get that self-education and you see where your folks have come from, right? Then you understand where you have to go and what you have to do. But the absence of not knowing that, you only know half of the story. Right, it's like Paul Harvey used to say, and the rest of the story, right? You need to know both sides of the story. And you'll find out if you know your family story, your lineage, your narrative, it's much, you will succeed in anything that you know based on their story. So for me, know your story. And if you don't know it, I'll walk you through it. I'll have you go interview everybody in your family, right? Because you need to know your story, because that's you. That's your history. That's your legacy.
You got to talk to those elders.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And before they leave, because there's an African proverb to say when an elder leaves, the library burns down.
Yep.
You got to get those stories before they go.
Absolutely.
And see, that's a good opportunity with me. I'm the family genealogist. So I did my grandmother, which was fascinating, going back to 1907. I mean, just her history, you know. And then doing Odessa's, I had to go to Tennessee and do Odessa's family history. So putting that all together, I learned a lot of what they had to go through. And Jerry's correct when he says, you know those stories. You're gonna call on them one day. They will help you out. They'll definitely help you out.
When my young people tell me they have a problem and I pull in their parents' story and their grandparents' story, their problem seems very small. Right. So they don't even understand what their ancestors went through. Right. If they even understand that, they have no reason to complain. Right. That's why I would tell, they said, Ms. Martin, aren't you mad? Don't you want to complain? I said, no, I got it. So I don't have no dogs chasing me. I ain't got no hoses. I don't have to face no lynching. I mean, in the classroom, I still think they're trying to kill us in the mind, but at least I'm aware of it. Right. And so why I need to complain, what I need to do is elevate your consciousness so you don't get stuck. And then all of a sudden history starts to repeat itself. Right. So my thing is to make sure that you know your stories.
Yeah, absolutely.
Your facts. Otherwise, somebody give you their facts and then you really start going crazy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, James and Jerry, I thank you so much for joining me tonight and sharing your family story. It's really been an inspiration to listen. It really has.
No, I appreciate it. And I appreciate you doing what you're doing.
Yes. Can you tell us a little bit about the trip you want to plan? Because I want to go.
Oh, so we have an upcoming legacy tour where the descendants of the 6AAA are planning to go back to and retrace the steps that our mothers took to Scotland, to Glasgow, Scotland, to Birmingham, England, and then to Normandy, Rouen, and Paris, France. Coming up probably in, it looks like mid-June to late June. The dates are still being firmed up. So it's going to be exciting.
That's excellent. Thank you for that.
And, I'm going to be there. I'm going to put my foot in where the places where my mother set her foot, right? And just the spiritual energy that will be there, you know, it's amazing. So thank you for what you do.
Thank you. But we're looking to go back to like the St. Edward School, the places where they stayed. And we're connecting with people who actually live in those countries and who there are support groups of the 6AAA in those countries.
Oh, beautiful.
And so we're connecting with them. So it's exciting.
Well, I'm glad you did that. And Jerry's eager to take that journey with you and do the photograph.
Well, thank you all so much.
All right. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for all of you who are listening to this, right? Because this is your story.
To my audience, thank you for listening to Next Us 818 Podcast. I hope you enjoyed our show. If you have questions or topics you'd like us to discuss, or you'd like to be a guest on the show, please email the show at nextus818podcast@gmail.com. That's nextus818podcast@gmail.com. I like to end each show with a favorite reflection. Tonight, I will share a quote from George Washington Carver. How far you go in life depends on your being tender with the young, compassionate with the aged, sympathetic with the striving, and tolerant with the weak and strong. Because someday in your life, you will have been all of these. See you for our next show on Wednesday, December 21st at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can catch the show on Anchor and Spotify.